Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Back in Studio A this morning with my guest, as I mentioned, from San Juan Health Partners Gastroenterology, Dr. Jason Glass is here with me this morning. Dr. Glass, good morning. Welcome to KSJE. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. You were telling me that March is a special month, right? This is Colon Cancer Awareness Month?
Yeah, it's Colon Cancer Awareness Month. It's a good time to think about getting your colon cancer screening.
Right.
Colon cancer is one of the most prevalent cancers in the United States. We have about 150,000 cases a year, and it's the second most common cause of cancer deaths in the country. So it's an important thing to talk about with your doctor.
Yeah, no kidding. And I guess, is it one of those types of cancers, though, if caught early, it has a lot of better outcomes, I guess, than maybe other types?
Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot of different screening options for colon cancer. A lot of people just think colonoscopy is the only option, but there are a multitude of options, and your primary care physician can definitely discuss that with you. And if you want, you can call our clinic and we can discuss that with you.
Okay. Are some a little less invasive maybe than colonoscopy?
Yeah, definitely. So there's two real different options for colon cancer screening. There's stool-based testing, and then there's direct visualization, so colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
Stool-based testing is designed to test for advanced adenomas, and an adenoma is a polyp. You might have heard of that term before. A polyp is something that gastroenterologists like to catch because, as you were saying, if you catch it early enough, you take it out, prevents that from progressing to a cancer.
Not all polyps become cancerous. Is that true, or do they all tend to become cancerous?
That's a good question. Not all polyps do become cancer.
But they're certainly worrisome, I guess, if you see one in an exam, right?
Yeah, certainly. We like to remove them. So polyps, they form from different genetic mutations, and over a long period of time, they can progress to cancer. And typically, that sequence takes about 10 years. So that's something that you might have heard of, getting a colonoscopy every 10 years. And so we like to do colonoscopies every 10 years, remove those polyps, and prevent them from growing into a cancer.
Gotcha. Yeah. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that's great preventative maintenance, if you will, for lack of a better term, I guess, for our bodies as we get older.
Yeah, definitely. So there are other tests besides colonoscopies, as we were alluding
yes.
to. There's two real tests that we recommend in the GI community. There's one called a FIT test, and that tests for a specific molecule in your blood cells that might be released by a big polyp or a cancer. That test needs to be done every year, but it's easy. You don't have to change your diet. You don't have to change your medications. You just give a stool sample and you send the card in, and do that every year. The only drawback to that sort of exam is that if it is positive, you do have to get a colonoscopy. There's another test called Cologuard. That's another test you might have seen on TV. It's like a little cartoon box dancing around. And that one is a test every 3 years. And it's a good test because it detects blood cells, but it also detects these different types of genetic malformations that might be found in polyps or cancer. So that one's done every 3 years.
Gotcha. And I guess all these things are looking for these warning signs, these abnormalities, and then you could request other more maybe better testing or more intrusive testing, I guess, just to confirm or not what you're finding or what you think you're finding.
Yeah, definitely. So those stool-based tests are really meant for average risk people. And what that means is someone that doesn't have any family history of colon cancer. And that's really a first degree family member. So your siblings or your parents or your children.
Sure.
and so if you do have those increased risk factors, the stool-based testing isn't for you, and colonoscopy really is for you.
And this is for, I keep interrupting you, and I do apologize, but I keep thinking about the things I want to ask you, which is a lot of these are age-based too, correct? And mostly as we get older.
That's correct. So traditionally, 50 was the age where you'd start screening. If you have a family history, 40 is the age, or 10 years before the first-degree family member was diagnosed with colon cancer, whichever one's earlier. But recently, we've been studying and seeing that there's a younger population that is developing colon cancer, which is concerning, and we don't really understand why. But the 50-plus population, we've seen the incidence of colon cancer decreasing, which is great. But in this 20 to 49-year-old population, we've been seeing it going up, and we really don't know why. So recently, a lot of professional guidelines have been recommending screening starting at age 45 as opposed to 50. So that's something that's relatively new in the last few years.
Got it. Yeah. And I guess if folks are going to their doctor regularly, that's something that he or she would probably recommend, knowing their medical history and family medical history and things like that, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Right. Is there any other warning signs, I guess, that even if you're younger and you notice something or feel something, that would maybe be a sign to maybe go get it checked out or ask a couple of questions?
Yeah. Usually colon cancer, unfortunately, is one of those cancers that are asymptomatic generally. Some of the warning signs, if you see any rectal bleeding, if you're noticing kind of new abdominal pain or new constipation, if your doctor checks your labs and they notice that your blood counts might be lower than they normally are, especially if there's a low iron level in your blood, that's another warning sign. But generally, the warning signs are there aren't any warning signs.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't feel a certain way, I guess, or maybe more fatigued or anything like that. It's just maybe could be a number of things, I suppose.
Yeah. There's a number of symptoms. They're usually very nonspecific.
Right.
But usually if you get your screening, your appropriate screening at the right age, you should be okay.
Right. Yeah. And that's a good thing. So that's important. Now, that's just one of the areas that you deal with, right, at your practice with Salmon Health Partners. It's a big one, I'm sure. And, of course, this is the month to pay attention to this. And so we'll be hearing a lot about the health of our colons, and it is an important organ in the body. It certainly helps with digestion. But talk to me a little bit about some of the other things that you work with, and you've been here for about, 2.5 years at Salmon Health Partners?
Yeah, for sure. GI, you know, it spans a lot of different areas of the gut, just all of your guts, really, your esophagus, your stomach,
really,
your small
from
intestines.
Start to finish, really, from what we're talking about,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of liver, pancreas, and those sorts of things. So yeah, just everything inside I can help you out with, acid reflux, indigestion.
Right.
You know, everything the Pepto-Bismol commercial kind of tells you about.
That maybe
nausea, heartburn, indigestion, all that stuff.
All those things. And I guess if that isn't helping anymore, is that when someone would come to see you maybe about their acid reflux or their other nausea problems or what have you?
Yeah.
How do you know if it's time to come make an appointment?
Yeah, if you know, your primary care doctor gives you a medication, or you go to your local pharmacy and have a medication and it doesn't really seem to be helping, that might be a good time to talk to your doctor about coming and seeing a gastroenterologist.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And what could that indicate, I guess? I mean, I know I don't want you to diagnose on the air necessarily, but I mean, are there any things that maybe tell you if someone has pretty bad nausea and it's not getting better, what that might mean?
It can mean a whole slew of things, you know. But when you have reflux, it can mean you have a hiatal hernia that might need a little bit stronger medication. You could have a condition called Barrett's esophagus, which is a condition where the esophagus kind of changes due to a lot of acid reflux, and that's something we definitely want to know about.
It's affecting the tissue, I guess, maybe on the inside. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, it could be a lot of different things, pancreas, gallbladder, definitely something I could help out with.
Right. But not just maybe one thing necessarily. You'd run some more tests and do some other diagnostics, I guess, to figure out exactly where to focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what we're talking about. But
yeah.
It's always amazing to me the complexity of the human body, right? And how many different things it's able to do and do well for decades, right? And then something happens and all of a sudden it could mess up maybe not just one thing, but maybe several things. Someone may present with multiple issues from one problem or what have you.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's something that I'm sure you you deal with as well with some of your patients that come to you.
All the time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so nausea might be just the presenting symptom, but there's other stuff going on.
Certainly. Yeah. Ulcers, celiac disease, all those sorts of different conditions, yeah, we deal with.
Right, right. And again, are some of these more age-related than others? Or, I mean, it's not unknown for a child to have hernia or something to that effect, I suppose, right?
Yeah, a lot of patients... hiatal hernias tend to be in the older population, things like celiac disease we tend to see in younger patients. So it can span, you know, I take care of patients that are 18 years and older, so.
Okay.
But you know,
remind me again, celiac disease, this is a sensitivity to something or am I off base here?
Yeah, it's a sensitivity to gluten. It's really a true allergy to gluten, and it causes damage to a specific part of your intestines that's involved in important absorption. So
gotcha.
Patients tend to present with diarrhea and nutrition deficiencies.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So we don't want to damage that
yeah.
body part either, because that can cause other issues, I suppose, right?
Yeah. The big thing we worry about with celiac disease, if it goes untreated for a long time, it could lead to a rare type of lymphoma. So we like to treat it, and the main treatment for it is a gluten-free diet.
Right.
Yeah.
Which seems like a fairly easy, I don't want to say easy, because if someone is suffering from this, they probably are not having an easy time of it, but it's less invasive than a surgical procedure or something else, I suppose, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an easy intervention. It's becoming easier now that there's a lot more gluten-free options.
Very true.
But we do a lot of times have to recruit our nutritionists to help with patient education and things like that.
Right, which is another, I guess, good thing about our local hospital and some of the things that are available to patients, right? You can just send them across the street or down the hall or what have you, right? You have those folks at your disposal.
Yeah.
And your patient's disposal.
Yeah, San Juan Regional, we have a lot of different specialists, you know, always working with our surgical colleagues and nutritionists and dietitians to help all take care of our patients in a multidisciplinary fashion.
Right, yeah. Right. Very good. And you deal also with problems with swallowing and things along that line. That makes me think about maybe someone who's had a stroke or something else, but maybe there's more to it than that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different conditions that could be associated with trouble swallowing. Probably the most common things we deal with are strictures due to acid reflux. When you get a lot of acid in your esophagus, you can develop a scar like you'd develop a scar on your finger or hand or skin. And that can build up over time and form like a little fibrous ring. So we
on the muscle, I guess, that controls the swallowing, is that the idea?
Yeah, there's a lot of different muscles involved with swallowing. Your esophagus or the swallowing pipe is just one big muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain motility conditions that can be... that can affect the way that you swallow and how those muscles really move to push that food down.
Right.
That is definitely something we see a lot, swallowing problems. But we have a lot of different ways to diagnose it. We have something called motility studies, our endoscopies, where we can look with the camera, and if we see anything that's causing a blockage, we usually can stretch it or order more testing.
Gotcha. But it is something that's a little more complicated, it sounds to me anyway, because of just how complex that muscle structure is in your throat.
Yeah, certainly. There's the muscles in the upper throat, there's the muscles kind of in the middle, and then there's another muscle at the bottom, which kind of prevents all that acid from coming up. So there could be problems with all three of those levels, and it takes multiple tests and people to kind of figure out what exactly is the root cause of those problems.
Gotcha. I mentioned strokes. Is that still something maybe that also affects swallowing? And in some cases, obviously, every stroke is different.
Yeah, strokes definitely can affect swallowing. Depends on how big the stroke is and where it kind of affects. But a lot of the times when someone does have a stroke, it can mess with the way that their upper muscles are moving and how they can coordinate the movement of the food from the front of the mouth to the back of the throat.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And that can be more of a brain muscle type of connection
exactly.
problem than the actual scarring of the esophagus, as you mentioned.
Exactly.
And I understand the difference. So mm-hmm. there you go. You mentioned ulcers too, which I want to talk about. And certainly we think about, I do anyway, stress
mm-hmm.
equals ulcers or can lead to ulcers. Is that a lot of the contributing factors, I guess, if someone has a stressful life, do they tend to have more gastrointestinal problems?
That's a great question. Stress, you know, typically the day-to-day stress that we deal with doesn't really lead to ulcers. It can lead to more of an upset stomach,
okay,
or indigestion, but it doesn't lead to a true ulcer. The most common cause of ulcers in the United States is NSAIDs, so ibuprofen, Advil, Motrin, and those types of medications. And then the second most common cause, which a lot of people don't know about, is a bacterial infection. It's called H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori. And it's an interesting way it was discovered. There is an Australian scientist who, I don't remember how, but he had a hole from the outside into his stomach, and he infected himself with this bacteria. And he was able to prove that this bacteria causes peptic ulcer disease or ulcers, and he actually won the Nobel Prize for that.
He did this on purpose?
Yes, he did that on purpose.
Okay. That's what I thought you were saying, but yeah. I just wanted to double check. Interesting. Yeah. And he had a theory, I guess, and then proved it.
Yeah, he proved it, and he won the Nobel Prize.
So okay.
It was a big discovery, and you know, it's easy to treat, and it's an important infection to know about, because that one can also lead to different types of cancers, like stomach cancer and lymphoma. And it's very prevalent in this community. We see a lot of it.
Do we?
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, how does that happen, I guess, if you don't have a hole in your stomach? I mean, how does that infection happen? Is it just through, I guess, obviously food or something,
yeah,
that gets into the system, right?
Yeah, it's usually through food and water.
Okay.
There is a theory that it can be transferred between family members, but it's usually through the food.
Gotcha.
It's relatively benign, and most of the time people don't know they have it.
Sure.
But indigestion is probably the most common symptom for that.
Gotcha.
And it can lead to ulcers. And
okay.
Yeah.
And you mentioned just, you know, you have an upset stomach and then being different than an ulcer. What are the, I guess, how different are they? I've never experienced an ulcer. Don't really want to.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly about an upset stomach. So is there a difference in the amount of pain maybe that you experience with an ulcer is forming, or what would you say?
Yeah, an ulcer can definitely present with abdominal pain. That's probably the most common symptom. It usually won't get better on its own.
I see.
Kind of common indigestion after you eat something. But in any event, other symptoms can be pain after you eat, because when you eat, it causes your stomach to produce acid, and then it kind of irritates the ulcer. And then when it gets a little bit more severe, it can lead to bleeding, and that usually you'll have nausea and vomiting, and you might see some blood, or you might see some black tarry stools. That's kind of another telltale sign. And that's the sign that you're digesting blood and that something might be wrong.
Right. Probably set off all kinds of warning signs, right,
to
get it checked out and go talk to someone like yourself,
yeah,
to figure out what exactly is going on.
Mm-hmm.
My guest this morning, Dr. Jason Glass, is here. He is with Semon Health Partners Gastroenterology, and we're talking about some of the things that he is able to diagnose and treat here in Farmington. And we're talking about a number of things. You mentioned that some of the things that you see somewhat regularly in this community, are there some other things that you see a lot of patients suffering from that come to see you here that maybe is different from other places?
Yeah, so, you know, a big part of my practice is liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a very high prevalence of liver disease in New Mexico, and a lot of it is from alcohol use, and it's an unfortunate thing that we see a lot every day. New Mexico has actually the highest rate of death in the country from liver disease. So I do deal with that a lot.
Right. And that's one of the next question is, what causes it? You said alcohol. And so I guess the treatment options are somewhat limited. I mean, you only have one liver, right? So
right.
You really have to live with it.
Take care of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the most common causes of liver disease in the United States are alcohol being one, and two is probably hepatitis C. there are a slew of liver diseases out there, alcohol being one of the most common, but there are a lot of other rarer causes. There's genetic causes, metabolic problems that can happen. and, you know, if your liver, if we can catch what the problem is early enough, we can, you know, the liver can regenerate itself. When it becomes scarred to the point where what we call cirrhosis, when the function of the liver is compromised and there's too much scarring, usually we can manage the side effects of cirrhosis with medications and things like that. But transplant, if your liver is really sick, transplant is really the only option.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But I guess if someone was a heavy drinker and they all of a sudden were able to beat that addiction, and their liver wasn't too damaged, the liver could come back to a certain degree?
Yeah, certainly. You know, if the liver is it's a remarkable organ. It does a lot of different functions. And if you do stop drinking, the liver can regenerate itself, and we can monitor and treat any sort of symptoms or signs of cirrhosis, again, with close monitoring, medications, and things like that.
Right. But if it's gone too far, I guess then the other option is transplant that you mentioned, which certainly is not guaranteed, I suppose, right? Is there how is that supply and demand in that field?
Yeah, so it's tough in New Mexico. You know, we don't have a transplant center here. Whereas I used to practice in Texas, and there's, you know, tons of transplant centers there.
Sure.
Transplantation is definitely a big deal. It requires a lot of work from the patient, and it requires a lot of work from multiple different doctors and specialists. So, and of course, it's a huge gift. So, you got to pick the right patient, and we usually send our patients to Colorado or Arizona.
Where they can have some of those resources, I guess, right?
Exactly.
And the networks to talk about those types of things.
Definitely.
But certainly a complicated procedure
for
transplanting an organ into another human being and seeing if it all matches and works the way it's supposed to.
Absolutely.
That's all part of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Are kidneys part of your area, or is that someone else?
That is someone else. That's usually a nephrologist.
Gotcha.
You know, the liver and the kidney do talk to each other.
Right.
And they are closely related, but... Yeah, I usually ask my kidney doctors to help me out with that.
There you go. Very good. Excellent. Well, what are some of the other things that you're seeing these days in your patients when they come and talk to you?
Run-of-the-mill diarrhea. That's another common one.
Okay.
Acid reflux. Yeah, abdominal pain.
So diarrhea. I mean, what can be done? There's obviously something not working properly, and so what do you have to do? Figure out what the cause is, obviously.
Yeah, most common causes of diarrhea are infection.
Mm-hmm.
We do see a fair amount of C. diff in the community. That usually happens if you're kind of in the hospital a lot, getting antibiotics, things like that. Another thing I see pretty commonly that's a cause of diarrhea is something called inflammatory bowel disease, and that's something that I manage quite frequently, and that's a chronic disease where your body kind of attacks your intestines. It's an autoimmune condition. You might have heard of Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Yeah, so that's another pretty common thing I see in my practice.
Gotcha. And what are the treatments for that? I imagine there's a few options, maybe, depending on what's going on.
You know, probably 20 to 30 years ago, the options were a little bit more limited, but nowadays we have a lot of different options for inflammatory bowel disease. And it really depends on how severe your disease is. If it's mild, we can usually give you some pills that will help with your diarrhea and inflammation. And if it's a little bit more severe, we give medications called biologics, which are kind of humanized antibodies, which usually requires an injection or infusion, and that can usually help a lot with patients with inflammatory bowel disease.
Interesting. It kind of resets, I guess, maybe some of the chemical makeup there to
fix
the problem.
Your immune system is kind of
You tell
ramped
I'm not
up.
A doctor, but
no, I'm going to
play one on TV.
Your immune system's kind of ramped up when you're having inflammatory bowel disease, and these medications kind of tell it to calm down a little bit.
I see.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the small intestine. And I know sometimes if there's a serious enough problem, maybe a segment of that organ is removed from a patient and it's sewn back together, and the patient's able to continue to live a fairly normal life. At least that's my understanding. And is that somewhat of a newer procedure? Has been around for a while, and what would cause, I guess, you have to actually remove part of someone's intestine?
Yeah, so in my realm of things, the most common cause of what we call small bowel resection would be from Crohn's disease. Crohn's disease can cause these strictures to form in the small intestines, and the strictures become so bad that you have a blockage. And when you have a blockage like that, a surgeon will go in and they'll remove that in disease segment of the small intestines and then put it back together. And most of the time, patients do okay. If it's really severe and they have to remove a lot of the segment of the small bowel, that can that can cause problems with absorption of certain nutrients. But yeah, most of the time patients do really well with small bowel resections.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Very good. And that's, again, one of the other things that is able to be done locally. There are surgeons that can do that here.
Yeah, we have awesome surgeons here, and they can definitely, and they always help out with that when I call them. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. Very, yeah, very good.
Absolutely get that done here.
Excellent. Very good. Well, anything else that we haven't touched on this morning in our conversation? We've kind of bounced around to almost all of your specialties, yeah. I would think, as I hope we have.
I don't think so. Yeah, GI is it's a pretty broad specialty. We can help out with a lot of things, and we try to help as best we can here locally. And if there's more kind of advanced things that we need, we usually will refer you out to one of our tertiary centers. New Mexico at UNM or University of Colorado, but yeah, you can come by and see me and I'll help out the best I can.
Okay. Very, very good. Where's your office located?
It's at 630 West Maple Street.
So right there near the hospital.
Yeah, right.
Sounds
there.
Like to me. So yeah. Very, very good. And this is, again, the month of March is colon cancer screening month. So yeah. Pay attention to your colon, everyone. And if you haven't been in a few years, like maybe 10, might be time to make an appointment.
Yeah, absolutely.
What it sounds like to me. Very good. Dr. Glass, thank you for coming in this morning. I appreciate
Thanks
it
for
very much.
Me. Yeah.
You're very welcome. That's Dr. Jason Glass from San Juan Health Partners Gastroenterology, my guest here on KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.